So this required programming bothers me. It looks like there is going to be someone who says to faculty, these are the right attitudes you should have. And if you do not have them, you, I don't know what the educational program is mandatory. Is there a test at the end where you say, I don't think the answers that are being prompted are correct, then what do you do to the faculty? This looks like ideology to me. This does not look like it's not a department meeting, at least not in my department. We don't have a test at the end that says you have conformed to the correct attitudes and you believe the right things, and therefore you are an accepted part of the community. This bothers me a lot. I think this is an infringement of academic freedom and thought.
Well, part of it is that there are hard things to talk about, and we have to learn how to talk about them. No one's talking about a test or at the end of this. It's simply to take us to a new level of how we think about things and how we treat each other and so on. But anyway, good points. Landon, and then Andre. Landon?
Yeah, so I think the intent behind these trainings is really good and important. I think that it's also important that we look at the research and what types of things work. There seems to be some research that suggests that, you know, short required online trainings may not be particularly effective, especially if the types of people who might benefit most from it are frustrated that they have to do it. And there, it looks like sometimes in the research, there's sometimes like kind of a backlash effect that people are angry that they had to do the training. I'm not sure what the exact solution is, because what seems to be maybe most effective would require people's buy-in beforehand and would be much longer and more intensive training. So for example, like I teach statistics sometimes, and we don't think that I could teach statistics in an afternoon. And I don't know that we could teach, systemic understandings of racial and ethnic inequality in society in an afternoon, especially in some sort of required online training. So I would just want whatever we did to be very intentional and evidence-based to make sure that it was effective and that it was the type of thing where it's going to do kind of more good than harm.
Yale and Avery, I think, will speak to many of those points, and they're all good. Andre, then Harold, then we want to move on. We're really running late here. Harold?
I fully agree with what Landon just said. And I might want to add, as a solution potentially to that problem, that an actual course might not work. But what I think works extremely well currently is that reading club that is going around that has, not only are you actually reading the book, but by discussing the content, you learn far more. And we are currently even in the process, at least in the group that I'm in, of coming up with policy solutions and suggestions for policy changes. So there's a much more forward-looking thing. And there's certainly, to what Richard said earlier, no need, and there probably shouldn't be any kind of test at the end. So the idea of these mandatory informational sessions has to be that people are informed and know how to talk about racial issues so that we can actually move forward and see, in fact, what policies are wrong and racist and what policies need changing and what new policies have to be introduced. And if we can create some kind of platform with that mandatory program, then we all will win from that. But you know, my major suggestion here being that I think these reading clubs work extremely well if especially the discussions are well structured as they are currently. Thank you.
Thank you, Harold, and then Abby, then we move on. Thank you, Harold.
Well, I take it that in calling for an educational program for faculty, that would be to address some kind of ignorance that members of the faculty have. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but if I'm wrong about that, I'd like some explanation then of what the point of such an educational program would be. But if I'm right about that, I'd like to get a clearer idea of what kind of ignorance it is that would need to be addressed. I mean, I know that when it comes to undergraduates, I see significant ignorance of history. And I do think that it's very valuable for people to learn about the history of racism, especially in this country, but really all over the world. But I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, is that the kind of ignorance that on the part of the faculty that would be being addressed by such an educational program?
Good points. I think I'm just speaking for myself. I find I'm sort of shocked at my ignorance of lots of things. For example, the Morrill Land Grant Act, which I'm discovering every day, things that I took for granted totally, all my life, and now I'm discovering that there's different sides to things. That to me, so I raise my hand. I'm ignorant of a lot of this stuff. And I think part of being liberally educated is to realize how little you know. And I will admit for myself how little I know about these things. And I think we others may feel the same way. But let's go on. Abby, then I'm running nervous here about getting all this in. Abby?
I guess just two points. One is I agree with all the concerns about how we do this and so on that's been raised. But I just think enough is enough. I don't think we as faculty just always get to opt out. I think that the president has called on all of us to engage with this very, very critical moment. And I don't see that we as the faculty again get to say, well, we don't have to do this. I understand it's tricky. And I think the what we have to do piece is very important. I think that I agree completely with what Andre was suggesting. To me, it's not addressing faculty ignorance, it's really calling on faculty engagement. And I think we need to do it. To me, it's about doing it in terms of all the activities we do as faculty. How do we engage in these issues in terms of both our teaching and research? And many of us feel like, well, what I do in my research doesn't touch on this, or it's irrelevant. I can stand at the sidelines on this. And I think, to me, what I'm trying to grapple with this summer is I think this is a moment where we can't stand on the sidelines. And so we have to ourselves, not by having the president call on us to do something or our Office of Faculty Development and Diversity call on us to do something. We ourselves have to engage.
Okay, Risa, very quickly, please.
Yeah, and this overlaps, so I won't simply repeat, but I think that one of the points that's coming out is that this should not be a training program that's simply called an educational program, that the problem with training is that it doesn't do the sort of work at multiple levels that we need. And I'd like to think of this working group F in relation to the first working group, that is to see the way in which our intellectual endeavors and our research and our teaching work together with activism, as opposed to some sort of separate notion of training, as opposed to the research and teaching. That if we have our peers who are doing this work, our peers in the faculty to lead whatever it is we end up doing, I think that's the way to do it, as opposed to having a separate kind of program that isn't connected to the work that our peers are doing already.
Good point. And I think the connection between this endeavor and what the center does and so on is pretty important. Okay, very good. So we'll take this and make some adjustments. But then again, remember, these things can be modified as we discover things in the next 1 and 2 months. Okay, let's hear from Angela Winfield. She spoke to the Senate last year. And she's very well versed in terms of what has been now put in front of the staff. And I asked her to come and just maybe briefly tell us a little bit about the ideas behind it, with the eye towards how it will apply to what we just talked about for faculty. Angela, are you here?
I am. Thank you, Charlie. And thank you all for having me. So what I want to share with you is just a little bit about how and why we developed what we did for the staff and how it might translate into your context. And I'll leave a lot of that to Avery and Yael, but I'll at least touch on that. So what we developed for the required program for staff is called Advancing Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Cornell. And the one of the first challenges that we had, and one of the first questions we asked ourselves is what is the purpose of this program? What are we really hoping to get out of it, especially if we're requiring it of all staff, knowing that we have staff from all different levels of educational background, of knowledge around diversity, equity, inclusion concepts. You know, what can we really do in a single program? And where we landed was this is a foundational program that gives us a common language to talk about these concepts in the context of our work. And the work of staff, again, is very different than faculty, but also very different from one another. So it's a broad audience. So that was really what we're looking at. How do we give us a common foundation and something to work with so that we have some context around these concepts, why we're talking about them at work, how they show up in our work, and providing some opportunities to engage, to practice, to figure out how to integrate this into what we do. So I'm going to walk you through just briefly the six components of the program. And actually, before I do that, let me just tell you the format of it. So the required portion is online. We developed this in connection with eCornell. So it's a series of short videos in each course. So there's six courses total. Each course has a series of 3 minute or less videos, and it's interspersed with different reflection exercises, tools, and resources so that folks can go deeper into it. And that's the online portion. There are some additional exercises in there. And then after they take the online portion, there's a voluntary optional opportunity to engage in community conversation, right? To go deeper into the concepts. If there are questions, concerns, if someone has a different point of view, we can have that in a facilitated dialogue. So that's the overall format for each of these six courses that will be launched. The first course in the program is really about line of sight. We talk about the mission, vision, and values of the university and how diversity and equity tie into that. You know, it really grounds the program, and it grounds it to the university specifically. As you move through to course two, we get into the more specifics about what it is that we're trying to achieve. So talking about what is inclusion, what is a culture of belonging, why are these things important to the university and what we do in the university? Also, what is respect? You know, giving us a common foundation and really defining the concepts. So those are the first two courses. Once you move into course three, that's where we get into the concepts of diversity, equity, inclusion. And I'll, before I get into that, let me just say that one of the things that we did specifically was think about what is diversity, what is equity, what is inclusion, and who are we talking to and what are we talking about when we do that. So when we get into course three, we're talking about social identity, we're talking about power, privilege, and oppression. And we're talking about that across identities. We had a lot of conversation about should this be specific to race? And we do talk quite a bit about race in this section of the program. But we also talk about other identities because there are folks in the staff population who have expertise, a level of expertise about race, racism, as well as inclusion and equity. So how do we incorporate them into the program? You know, one of the things that we didn't want to have happen is to put a requirement on, I'm going to be, you know, really plain about this, you know, folks of color who say, you know, why am I learning about this? So how do we give them something that's new and engaging and something for them to engage with as well as folks who may not be as familiar with these concepts. So that's that section. We talk about power, privilege, oppression. We also talk about the cycles of socialization and liberation. And, you know, how this comes about, and also how, you know, theoretically we get out of oppression. Then we move into the final three courses, courses 4, 5, and 6. And this is where we shift more into the practical, what do we do? How do we incorporate this? What are the skills that are going to be helpful? Because there's a lot of difficulty, there's a lot of discomfort, there's a lot of fear around talking about these concepts and engaging in these concepts. So course 4 is focused all around listening and communicating across difference. Right? It's not about changing people's ideas, beliefs, or perspectives per se, right? Because part of diversity is having those different ideas, thoughts, perspectives, experiences, but how do we leverage that and engage it, right? How do we engage it? So one of the skills is communicating across difference. So we dive deep into that, both sharing your perspective, and then also listening to a perspective different from your own. The fifth course is centered around speaking up and intervening and taking action when we see things that don't necessarily align and that may be, you know, racist, bias, discrimination. We see this a lot where people don't know how, don't know what to do, and this part of the program, you know, goes into that. Here, what are your options? How can you practice being an intervener and speaking up when needed? And then the final course is around translating equity into your functional position, right? So if you are a finance person, if you are a grounds person, if you are in administration, what does it look like to apply an equity lens to what you're doing in your job? So that is, in essence, a nutshell, what the program does, knowing that this is just a foundation. Right? It's the basis. We'll have an opportunity to have people engage in community conversations, and that will be across colleges and units. We're also providing facilitation guides within colleges and units for departments, teams, and groups who want to have their own conversation and talk about what it means for them specifically. We're going to provide them with those materials as well. And then also knowing that people may want to go deeper, so we'll provide additional opportunities for that. But this is a foundational course. And for the faculty, I know there's many differences and needs. You know, one of the things and one of the contexts that I'll, you know, put out there is that the course that we develop for staff is very much focused on engaging with one another as teams, getting work done more effectively, getting work done in a more innovative way, and then translating that. So everything that we're trying to teach are the core principles. It's not just about the history. They do get some history. They do get you know, some background and context, but it's not about making them experts in the concepts of diversity, equity, inclusion. We can't do that, right? We can't do that in a 6-course program, and we can't do it in 6 months. That takes a long period of time, but what we are giving them are the critical key areas to help them be more active and to begin to think about how their behavior may impact our climate and may impact the culture for each other. So for faculty, you know, there are different contexts that you can look at this in. You can look at it in terms of your relationships with one another in your departments. You can also look at it as what happens in the classroom, and where you want to go with that is, you know, up to you. But I will pause here and see if there are any questions about the staff program, and then Charlie, I'll let you turn it over to Yael and Avery to talk about their thoughts.
Thanks a lot, Angela. There's a lot of good comments in the chat and so on. Would anyone like to ask Angela a question right now? I think there's a lot to learn from this. And okay, Thanks so much, Angela. I'm sure we'll be in touch in the coming weeks. I really appreciate you coming by.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And the information, if you want more details about the program, there is a website that provides descriptions of each of the courses. And of course, I'm available if there are any other questions.
Thanks an awful lot, Angela. The link is up on the agenda page, faculty. So please take note of that. Okay, Avery and Yale.
Can you, if you stop sharing, we can share our slides. Thank you. Thank you all, and thank you, Angela, for that overview of the new staff program. So what Charlie and Nima asked us to do, I'm Avery August, the Vice Provost of Academic Affairs, and I oversee the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity. What Charlie and Nima asked us to do is to share what we currently do, which are programs that are not the same as the staff programs. And listening to the conversation, I will just say that many of our approaches take the approaches that you all suggest, which are engagement, reflection, and discussion. So let me just turn it over to Yael, who can share, as she's the director of the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity, who can share what we do out of her office. Yael?
So our office really focuses on processes around faculty work when it comes to bias and climate. The first program is Depends on the Lens, and it focuses on effective search practices. It's a video and an engaged conversation. Usually, many times, departments invite me afterwards either to a conversation with a committee or with the chair to kind of clarify more things. It's also connected to the fourth bullet point, which is the best practices in hiring and recruitment, which is on our website. All of these things are linked, by the way. I would say that since 2009, probably three quarters of the faculty have gone through this program, initially voluntarily. Later, I think most of the colleges now require it from search committees. The second portion is the effective academic interviewing. So you've made a selection, now you're bringing people to campus, and some of them are running as quickly as they can away because of the odd behavior of faculty. So this is really about how to create an inclusive environment in the interviewing process. And I would say that since it was launched, there's about 80 to 100 people, again, voluntary taking this session. The third session is Viewpoints on Tenure and Promotion. It's aimed at tenured faculty. It was done later. I think we launched it about 5 years ago. And that's really about things that you should consider, like teaching evaluation across collaborative work, a whole bunch of things, and diversity in the tenure and promotion process. And about 300 people have gone through that in the last few years. It was a slower launch. We have tools on our website that support these workshops. As I said, best practices in hiring and recruitment, best practices in mentoring. And also we've launched earlier this summer a page that sends you to many other programs, both at Cornell and nationally. The Cornell Interactive Theater Ensemble was charged about 3 years ago with going department by department with a program called Hang In There and Be Tough about classroom climate. I think about 30 or 40 departments have brought the site to the campus. And your deans and your chairs have agreed that this was a valuable program. And so therefore we decided to offer it to each department. I think all the engineering departments, CALS, have gone through it. The Center of Teaching Innovation for Teaching Innovation provides other programs that focus on classroom environments. The Teaching and Learning in Diverse Classroom, which was launched 2 years ago, has about 164 faculty taking it, all voluntarily. Faculty Institute of Diversity, which is a two-day, much more intensive, had over the last 10, 12 years, about 250 faculty engage in it. And Let's Get Real, conversation about diversity in teaching, also offered by CTI. There's about 127 faculty engaged. And I'm sure there are some overlaps here, so it's not discrete faculty. The Intergroup Dialogue Project is launching a program this Friday, and it was limited to 50, and it was filled by 50 faculty, called Building Connection with Dialogue. So some of you have taken over the summer. You've engaged in a two-hour workshop. Now we're offering in collaboration with IDP, but really IDP is running the whole thing. A program that is 10 hours where you can engage more deeply. Avery, so I'll just say to Julian, I think, Schnabel, who kind of talked about training. None of these things are training, they're workshops, they all build on each other. And I agree with Neil Lewis's analysis that this alone will not get us where we need. So the next slide will show you some other things we're doing. Avery, it's freezing on my screen, so I can't see the next. Okay, so it has to be coupled with some accountability structures, and it has to be coupled with funding. And in 2013, the deans have agreed to insert accountability structures into the search process, where the searches are looked at various points at the beginning of the search before the shortlist is made and at the end. And in 2017, any college that wasn't engaging in that hiring accountability process was unable to access the bridge funding or other forms of funding. 2 years ago, we also launched the statement for contribution to diversity, which all candidates are supposed to come up with. And Avery, do you want to take it from there?
Yes, and so the other piece is just a more defined guideline on the inclusion for recognition, explicit recognition of diversity within tenure dossiers, and that's linked to the Faculty Senate website through the Dean of Faculty on the tenure project for more information. We also provide funding to incentivize increasing faculty diversity. That are linked to many of these programs, including the Provost Faculty Fellow. This is a postdoctoral-like program that candidates who are hired can start up to 2 years and then transition to their tenure track position. That's linked to bridge funding, which is 75% equivalent of the salary of the candidate, goes to the college for 5 years, that incentivizes funding. We also recently awarded two faculty diversity awards this past spring. So we have small group mentoring grants. We support faculty on the National Center for Faculty Development and Diversity for all faculty here on the campus. We built a pipeline too with institution resource and planning so that you can identify which institutions graduate faculty who could, or students who could potentially diversify, or faculty, and we encourage departments to use those. And we know that some departments do if they hire straight out of the PhD. We were planning a summit to bring potential underrepresented advanced PhD students here on the campus. This was supposed to be this summer, but was disrupted by the COVID crisis. And so we've postponed that. And we also built into the Cornell Presidential Postdoctoral Fellowship Program additional slots to support candidates who could contribute to the diversity of our postdoc as well as faculty pool. We spend a lot of time working on retention, climate, and community, with monthly get-togethers with various faculty groups. We do exit interviews for those faculty who do leave after they leave to understand the nature of their experiences here. We've spent time, and Yael can share some of these, and this came, some of these came through the Senate, meeting time for parents, such that meetings are held during business hours and a parental leave attestation to ensure that the parental leave that we do provide is equitable. And then we just want to spend a few more minutes talking about the dynamics of faculty demographics. Much of our work is tied to enhancing the recruitment of faculty who diversify our ranks here on the campus. Here, what you can see is the dynamics of faculty demographics over a period of time starting in 1982-83. Records are hard to keep the farther you go back in terms of what who is called what. But you can see here that we've made steady progress in increasing the proportion of both women faculty as well as faculty who diversify our ranks on the campus. Just overall, looking at the dynamics of underrepresented faculty since 2009, the last 10 years roughly, we've had roughly 41% increase in the number of faculty At the same time, Cornell faculty number only increased 2.5%. And nationally, underrepresented minority PhD production increased by 21%. So we're significantly ahead of overall PhD production in terms of how we recruit. Obviously, we want to do a lot more. And we think many of the things that we do and more of what we would like to do will allow us to do that. But I just wanted to put this in context for the senators. If we look at gender, we can see here again that we've made significant progress. If we look at the last 7 years, a 21% increase in the number of women among our ranks, whereas before the last five, six-year periods, progress was much slower. And this, I would say, coincide with more deliberate attention to ensuring that faculty searches are carried out in particular ways such that they're equitable and fair. Here again, you can see here broken down by STEM and non-STEM gender. The non-STEM faculty gender tends to be more equal in terms of proportion compared to the STEM. And you can see here that the arrows indicate the announcements of bridge funding for ensuring diversity of the faculty. And you can see that each time we have had a proportionate increase in the number of new faculty appointments that come with regards to gender. And then finally, by race and ethnicity, again, a similar analysis. Over the last 7 years, we've had roughly 30 to 35% increase compared to the last 2 5-year periods where the rates of progress was much slower. And again, this comes from a deliberate attention to many of the issues that we have workshops on. These are all very public data. You can see these on the IRP dashboard, but this just indicates the composition of diversity of new faculty who come in each year here. These are all ranked professors. And you can see here for the fall 2019, about 16% of the faculty we hired were underrepresented faculty, and another 10% were minority faculty, and 47% were female. If we go at the assistant professor rank, where about 60 to 70% of our hiring exists, you can see more progress on the gender front, where 54% of the new faculty coming in of assistant professors were female, almost 26% were underrepresented faculty, and another 11% were minority faculty. And then, you know, as we go to the associate professor ranks, those decrease, but again, still significantly above where we are as a current faculty. I'll just go through this quickly because these are public data and we want to make sure we have some time for questions. So with that, we'll stop. We're happy to take questions. Please contact us at these links here, and I'll stop sharing and allow questions. Thank you.
Thank you for all the overview. It's very instructive. I think combined with Angela's presentation, I think we're in a good position to reason our way to the next step. There's also lots of good chat for us.
Yeah, so Charlie, we're also happy to answer questions on the most recent progress on the most recent provost faculty diversity task force, where many of the things that we're doing now came out of the task force recommendations. And so we're happy to share any progress if people have questions about that as well.
So to answer Wendy, I would say the core lens is about 1,300 faculty have participated in that. In the interview, probably 600-700, and then the other one 300, and then we provided numbers for the programs that CTI, it's overall, I think, 500-600 people, but some of them might have taken the same programs.
So just to respond to Tracy's question on the chat, and Tracy points out it's still at most 50-50, which means for women, the number isn't increasing. It's where the current university rates is around 34%, I think. This is across all ranks. And so this is an important point, Tracy, when we talk about, the overall dynamics of our faculty diversity. It's one, of course, that our offices pay particular attention to. Given the size of our faculty, We hire, at least in the last round, last fall, as you can see there, there were it was over 50% in terms of the proportion of women that were coming in. And this is on the backdrop, of course, of, you know, roughly 1600 faculty. So, you know, just based on the dynamics of faculty hiring, we hire about, you know, 80 to 100 faculty per year, depending on college recruitment. You can do the math and figure out how long it would take for us to do, to completely get to where we would like to be. Now, that is not to say that we shouldn't be doing any of these things, but it just makes it more acute that we spend all the time that we can within departments who are actually doing the hiring to ensure that we both have candidates in our pool that can diversify our faculty and that the processes for evaluation is fair and equitable.
Okay.
Risa Leibowitz has her name hand up.
Thanks for the presentations. Avery, I think that you mentioned something pertaining to this, but I wonder if you could say something more about issues of retention. How do you feel we're doing on retaining faculty as we increase diversity of hiring? And Yael, it looks like you might have something to say there too.
Yeah. So it's a really important issue, Risa. And one of the things that we worry about is that we provide an environment here for, even with all the best efforts to recruit faculty, if we don't have an environment that's hospitable and welcoming to the faculty, then they don't stay. And that is actually worse in my view. So we do spend time talking about and working through retention practices. We work with chairs, we work with associate deans and deans on approaches. Each retention is unique. Each person who is looking to leave has a different reason for leaving. And so we work through with chairs and associate deans strategies for how to go about trying to do that. And so it's varied. Sometimes it's Ithaca, sometimes it's the discipline, sometimes it's just an offer that someone can't refuse. Yael and I have been speaking to faculty who've been leaving, and Yael can share more about some of the things that we found. But this is a very, very important point and goes to the climate in departments as well.
Yeah, so to answer your question, Ariel and Risa, yes, we do exit interviews. We do find that dual career is a huge issue, but climate in some departments is also a huge issue. The competing offers are sometimes really, really lucrative, but I would also say that the way that chairs and deans do that differs sometimes between institutions. Sometimes when someone is being recruited, they have the president of the university call. We don't necessarily deploy in every departure the president and the provost to call, and maybe that's something to consider. But I would say that we're improving a bit on our numbers. So 2-3 years ago, we'd see, and it has to do with the number of people we recruit, we'd see almost 20% people leaving. So we'd hire four and one would leave, and that would become 20%. And right now we see it at about, over the last 10 years, at about 14%, which is still higher than white and Asian faculty. On gender, we see at parity about 8-9% of faculty leave after tenure or before getting, after tenure. So we work, and there are chairs who come to their deans and the deans come to the provost's office to discuss retention. While we don't have pots, and we have no pots, general pots for anything, even the recruitment is a rolling average, the provost does intervene sometimes in retention offers and provides resources, right, Avery?
That's correct. And again, it all depends on, what's the nature. As I said, each retention, case is different in terms of what the individual sees would keep them at Cornell.
I'll just say one last thing, that we see more departures in social sciences and humanities than in the sciences, to a certain extent, because it's sometimes easier to, there are issues in social science and humanities, but also it's harder to move a whole lab sometimes than, to move 15 people than to move a person, basically.
Okay. Thank you very much, Yael and Avery. I'm sure we'll be in touch in the coming weeks on all this stuff. So we're at time, but I do think if we can just stick around just for another 10 minutes, it would be really great to hear our last speaker. Tao Lee Goff is a new professor in Africana. And the reason I think it's important to hear from Tao is that she's participated in the Milstein program. I mean, the question is like, what's the connection? What does all this mean for STEM instructors, you know? We can understand, you know, the social science and humanities side, but when you think of rethinking curriculum and so on, you maybe pause a little bit if you're in the STEM area. Anyway, Tao has worked at that interface and has some really interesting experiences that I asked her to maybe come and share these with us. So Tao, are you here? Yeah. I asked if you have to go, it's okay. Everything will be online and so on, but Tao, take it away. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Charlie. I'm just really honored to be here. Thanks for the invitation. And thank you, Jill, for help with the presentation. So yeah, I'm here today to talk about technology, humanities, and STEM instruction, and why this question of diversity should matter to the sciences, to Cornell Tech. So I'll speak about my experience having taught there and my role as a senior curator at Cornell Tech. So I'm a joint hire 50-50 between Africana studies and feminist gender and sexuality studies. And I began here at Cornell last year. And I think that, you know, it's just been really great to hear the conversation prior to now to kind of think about, you know, this national conversation regarding diversity. Because I think we have to talk about how diversity has become a kind of dirty word in a sense. And how it is that, you know, people are calling to divest from diversity, and people are saying that, you know, why don't we put that money towards cluster hires for faculty of color in particular? Because it's common that you hear about a kind of exodus of faculty of color, you hear that diversity is lip service, you hear that, you know, a lot of these Ivy League institutions are revolving doors for faculty of color who look like me, right? And Elizabeth Alexander has written a piece about that many years ago when she was at Yale and left. So I think we ought to consider that maybe there's a new language for what it is that we're talking about. And there's ways that we can think about research for each of us. And this is the question of bridging technology, the humanities, and STEM instruction. And I can share a bit about my practice and how I actually think through this in terms of DJing, which I do as well as being a professor. So I joke that I'm a PhD DJ because of the ways that I deploy technology in the classroom and music. So yeah, Jill, can we go to the next slide? Great. So some of you might have seen on this email that goes out to all of us from the Cornell Chronicle, this article, Bridging Tech and the Humanities Virtually. So I have the honor of teaching as part of the Milstein program, a workshop that I was asked to design, and I decided to call it Sound and Color. So a way to think through music and race and the way that music bridges different cultures and the kind of question of technology. So looking at the gramophone to the MP3. So really thinking about the rich heritage we have at Cornell in terms of Moog, the synthesizer, and to trouble this question of what electronic dance music is. And I think this is a perfect way that we can consider the way that sound and sound technology is not often thought about in terms of STEM, but it's so critical to the work that I do in terms of digital DJing. So you can read more in the article about this 10-week course that we taught over the summer, and it was 2 hours a week, but the students were there 2 hours every day, Monday through Saturday. And it was a real crash course in how to teach through Zoom, which was a real challenge. The next slide, please. So yeah, this is something that is a part of my research. I was interviewed by the New York Times last year about women and DJing. So this is another way that we might think about diversity, gender. And the finding was that a lot of women who DJ are actually part of collectives. So this had me thinking about, what does it mean to be a DJ? And how might we, instead of thinking of a center, think about the language of a laboratory, right? In what ways is a DJ a professor DJ in terms of the syllabi that we create, thinking of it as a kind of mixtape in a sense, and how, what would it mean to kind of co-teach, to collaborate and DJ together? So next slide, please. So this really went into how I taught this class, a brand new class, Electronic Music and Technologies of Empire. And yeah, it was just really wonderful to work with these 40 students. So rising freshmen and sophomores in the Milstein program. And we talked about the technology of empire. So really thinking about infrastructure, thinking about World War II, PA systems, radar, sonar. And yeah, computer science is entirely relevant to this question, as well as the fact that we would have been on Roosevelt Island, we would have been at Cornell Tech, but we were all online. So I think that we really ought to consider how research is key, because if we're to think of the intellectual stakes of this conversation, everyone at Cornell is producing research on land. You know, that is, as Charlie mentioned, regarding the Morrill Act, it's stolen land, right? So my question is, how could we think of the university as an engine, not of settler colonialism, right? Not as a space where we think about the, you know, production of financial instruments in the econ department or of weapons, right? Military weapons in terms of what's being produced for the Department of Defense, or to think about gentrification, that we could actually think about what sort of work could be done in the humanities by using the model of a laboratory coming from the sciences to develop something new. So can we see the next slide? Great. So brand new at Cornell and with, two grants of support from the Rural Humanities, part of the Society of the Humanities, and the Atkinson Center here on sustainability, along with another new professor, a Native American filmmaker who's Kiowa, Jeffrey Palmer, I have begun this laboratory called the Dark Laboratory. So we're going to have our launch party on October 12th on Zoom. It'll be recorded in case you can't make it. But we really are setting about this question of how we can change this conversation and consider the kind of underside, right? The kind of dark history, the kind of landscape of freedom and abolition at Cornell in Ithaca regarding the Underground Railroad, regarding the Cayuga people, right? Regarding the Lenape, and how it is that all of the research that we create, you know, depends on these ill-gotten gains, right? If we think about indigenous land and the people who continue to live in these communities. Okay, so next slide. So yeah, we really are embarking on this. We're fundraising right now and we're really excited that this could be a multi-institutional venture. We heard about the Rutgers Initiative, thinking about global racial justice. We're similarly thinking globally, but we think that Ithaca can be a case study for the world to think about Black and indigenous people in particular, and how it is that the dispossession of Native sovereignty is entangled with African enslavement when we consider the endowment of these universities, and especially land-grant universities. So we have a really wonderful advisory board of folks from other institutions, from Hollywood to Silicon Valley to academia. So Henry Louis Gates Jr. from Harvard is helping us out, as is Tamar Evangelastia Doherty, who's also new to Cornell and is an associate university librarian here. So we're going to be doing archival work to think about these questions. Next slide. So again, we want to emphasize that there's a national, international debate on abolition. And really, we can see that in upstate New York. We can see it in the sense of Harriet Tubman's house. We can see it in the sense of burial grounds of enslaved people, of Indian mounds. And this is something that we think that everyone who's a part of Cornell should be reckoning with, perhaps an orientation, because it's relevant to us all. Next slide. Great, okay, so that concludes the slides that I had to share. And I just wanted to share my screen if we have a little bit of time, just so that you can see a video, so a trailer that I made for this class, Sound and Color, where we were using virtual reality. A new world hangs outside the window, beautiful and shiny. So I designed that video and was able to think about the technologies that were required to make it and to foreground that for the students in terms of sound and color. So again, thinking about race and this history of technology. I know that we're short on time, so I just wanted to share that students are really excited about this question too, in terms of STEM, tech, how diversity is relevant. A student just shared this document with me and what they're working on. We hope that you'll all RSVP for the block party, the virtual event on October 12th, Indigenous Peoples Day, where we will talk more about Dark Laboratory and the kind of stories that we want to give a platform to. So here is a sneak preview of the website, and you can see that we're highlighting constellations of Afro-Indigenous thought and, again, this landscape of abolition in upstate New York. Okay. And then I wanted to just conclude with an example of student work. So this is a video called Humanity, Sound and Color, that my students created in the summer. And it just shows you that they understand there's something really profound taking place amidst this crisis. And this is an original song that my students actually produced themselves and video. So I'm just gonna play 30 seconds of it for you, and you can get a sense of how they're thinking about the soundtrack of COVID, of the protests. So I'll pause it there, but you can get a taste of what I was able to get students to produce and work together collaboratively to, you know, produce original music, to make these videos, to learn sound video editing, and to think about STEM, to think about technology and humanity, because that's so critical to the title of the Milstein program, right? Humanity is part of the title, not humanities, and we want to, you know, think about the fact that the students are already asking these questions, and we want to encourage that work. So yeah, thank you for your time. Oh, I think you're on mute, Charlie.
Mute. Tao, thank you. That was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, exactly that. So thank you so much. You know, there's a world shortage of people who straddle the humanities and STEM, and we're really lucky to have you on campus. If people can stick around, we have a couple of questions. I see Carl and Peter have their hands up. So Carl.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And I'm in physics, and we're concerned about the these issues of diversity. And I also appreciate very much we seem to be stalled in the hiring, but I'm a little concerned about some of the premises were just expressed about where we are, and I think it bears a some critical discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you for your presentation, but I think it's going to take more than the time we have right now to come to a better understanding. Mm-hmm.
I agree. I appreciate that. And I think part of it is that we need new language. We need new ways to think about land acknowledgement and how that's insufficient in its current form. So these are things we're hoping to do with the laboratory.
Thank you.
And Peter.
I'm just curious about your research. Have you invoked or thought of, you probably have, something called chromesthesia in your research?
Yes, yeah. So I'm definitely thinking in a sensory way, like how can we trouble the sense of the archive and think about embodied knowledge? So I would love to hear more about that. But I think color theory can be a useful metaphor, because what I see as blue may not be what you experience as blue. Yeah, and that was really why sound and color was a useful title for me.
So the chromesthesia is the individuals who sense color when they hear music.
Right, and we talked about synesthesia and the fact that I think it's like 4% of people, they say, have this. And it's interesting to think about feeling what you should taste, or this kind of crisscrossing of the senses and a sort of empathy.
There was a school of art that came out of China probably 20, 25 years ago, maybe, with some of the practitioners in the school supposedly had this affliction. And the colorful works of art that came out of this fantastically primary colored art that came out of people like Zhang Taifeng and stuff is really something that you might, if you don't know the guy's name, you might want to look into.
Yeah, thank you. Spectacular stuff.
I've got one hanging in my house at home.
Yeah, thanks. I feel like there's so much we can learn from people who experience the world that way.
Risa.
Yeah, thanks. That was a great presentation. And I think the timing of your presentation, Tao, was really, really interesting, like you said, after the discussion we had, because it seems to me that what you're pointing to is what happens when we do institutional self-analysis. That it's not simply, oh, well, let's talk about issues as if they're separate from us. Yeah. So it seems to me that the discussion about whether we're going to have a center on anti-racism and what should we do with regard to teaching, what should we do with regard to ourselves, mm-hmm. is that kind of self-analysis at multiple levels. And I think it's a very powerful thing to do. And once you start it, it's very difficult to unsee that. And that's why I think it's so powerful. And so one of the things I also wanted to bring in terms of issues of, you know, colonizing and oppression is to actually, you know, the study of the Cornell Tech program itself and the relationships that have been criticized, you know, over, sorry, the cat's going by here. to, you know, bring in the issues of choices to make, to have relationships with, you know, the Technion and questions of Palestinian rights. And these are, you know, as I said, once you start to do that institutional analysis and you think not only historically in the long term, but also more short term, it becomes a very powerful way to actually bring these issues into our historical and current discussions.
Exactly. And I feel like, you know, I met all of these tech bros at Cornell Tech and they don't know what I'm talking about, but it was a real learning experience because I think it does involve all of us. And I think that those coders might not be aware of the way that they're reproducing these asymmetries, but I think we're already ahead of that in terms of Austin Bunn being appointed as the new director. I learned about Cornell Tech from Amy Verejo, who was so helpful. And the fact that they're both in performing and media arts says a lot. You know, the fact that Austin is a filmmaker, is a screenwriter, says a lot about Cornell's commitment to the humanities. And then the last thing I would just say is that the hip hop archive is also really exciting here. And we can think about what forms are not considered technology or resource or research that actually are. Right. So I think it's amazing that we have this resource of the hip hop archive and we could really think about what it could do at Rosedale Island and involving Cornell Tech more in this conversation.
Yeah. And I'm also saying, you know, to, of course, raise a critique, just as you're talking about in terms of Cornell's being built on stolen land. Yeah. You know, that's a serious institutional critique. And then I think that critique has to continue. And many of us have raised it already with regard mm-hmm. to Cornell Tech and how it was developed and those relationships that have been built. So I just think that's a very powerful notion, especially if we keep pushing the critique.
Yeah, because people are being displaced as we speak, right?
Okay, we'll do what we're going to end the recording, and you can stick around. This is what Todd, we call hallway chat. It's as if